I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Well, today on the podcast, I'm delighted to have Belinda Bowman. And listen, you folks don't know this, but I'm going to tell you. You know how you can leave things in the background you don't really have to tell, but I'm kind of a tell-all person. So this is the second time we have tried to connect, and dear Belinda was ill the first time, and now this time we're connecting, and my dad is in hospice, and you know, by the time you listen to this, he may have transitioned from this world, and but so it's interesting that this has been a difficult podcast to make the connection for, and I always think that that's because it's an extremely important topic. Every once in a while, this happens with a guest. And, you know, there is resistance in this world. We know that, right? So if we're followers of Christ, if we have faith. So I just want you to know that Belinda is here, and I'm grateful for that. She's the founder of 1 Million Thumbprints. We're going to find out more about that. It's a movement of peacemakers advocating with women in the world's worst conflict zones. And she'll say a little bit more about that. She's also the co-founder of Silence is Not Spiritual. And you can guess what that is, a campaign calling churches to break the silence on violence against women. Maybe some of you have had the joy of hearing her speak. She speaks around the globe, and she also is a contributor to many publications, and you may have read her. If not, maybe you've already read Brave Souls, which we are going to focus in on today. Subtitle of that book is Experiencing the Audacious Power of Empathy. So, Belinda, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Anita, what a joy to be with you today. Thank you. And I agree. It has been, I think, a battle is a good term for us to use. We have battled our way to this talk, and I am really excited about what could come of it.
Yeah, amen to that. And it's so good to have you. You know, one of the things I always like to ask a guest, especially if they happen to be an author, is really what brought you to committing this topic to print? I mean, there's always a story. And I know that your book is no different. I've read portions of this story, and I know some of it even centers on a particular woman that you met. But I want to hear from your viewpoint, really what got you to put pen to paper and what crystallized this whole topic of empathy for you.
It's funny that you say, you know, we've kind of wrestled our way to this dialogue. I wrestled my way into the actual words of this book being put to print as well. Brave Souls was written three times over the span of 3 years, and no less than 157,000 words have passed over my computer in that time. And he was really quick to point out, he said, you know, Belinda, that's about the size and the time frame for a PhD. And I thought, you know, you're right. And as I spent time with that moment, I reflected on, wow, would I have given up, you know, the book that I hold in my hands today for this PhD degree? And what? I have no idea. However, I would not. The wrestle to get to the point that empathy is more important now for the body of Christ than ever before is driving me to not only, you know, to not only commit my words to print, but also to speak about them. I look at Brave Souls a bit like a permission slip. In permission slip for me, but also for those of us with faith, in whatever denomination, in whatever background and worldview we're coming from. It's for every person who's hungry for something more than just an angry protest, or like a group air hug. I feel like we've exchanged this idea of being compassionate for competition. And those of us that worry that we've kind of sold out our souls for a thumb, you know, for a thumbs up from our tribe, or maybe even simply just a better argument than the other guy. I feel like Brave Souls and the three times I wrote it has finally come to the place where, for those of us that want to tell the truth and take this audacious risk to not only know about other people, but to care deeply about them, and then to let all of that, our knowing and our caring about others, inform all of our actions towards that person. This is our permission slip. This is both the science and the scripture. I needed that permission slip because I was flailing in my responses to other people's suffering, even though I had been working in community development in war zones and for decades and had been a Christian for almost 30 years. My responses to suffering were a mess.
Hey, question about that. Because one of the things, or a couple of things that crossed my mind, even as you were introducing the topic, you know, you said empathy is so important for the body of Christ, and I was just going to even broaden that. I mean, for our world, I think in the whole world, it's something that's on the decline. And I feel like narcissism is on the rise. And, you know, I know exactly what the why of that, and I'm sure we'll get into some of that. But, there's something, one of the last things you said that got me, because you just mentioned you had been in war-torn countries, you had spent decades in some of these areas of the world. Was it, you know, we often use the phrase, and it's probably cliche, but compassion fatigue that you had experienced? And and I know compassion is different than empathy, and I do want us to get into definitions too, because I think that will also be helpful. So, okay, that's my interjection. You can respond to that.
Sure. So the story behind the story, other than Brave Souls was written a number of times, it is my PhD. That's what I call it.
Yes.
The sense of my life being disrupted. I think a lot of people that would pick up Brave Souls would be super tempted to say, oh, yeah, I know this story. I've heard it before, either in church or the more cynical of us, I heard it, you know, on BuzzFeed or whatever. And maybe the headline looks a little bit more like, you know, sheltered white woman shocked into reality after meeting Congo war survivor. And you know what? I would roll my eyes so hard that you could hear it too, if that was my story, but it's not. I really was not a stranger to suffering. War was not new to me. However, you mentioned the what, which is empathy. But for me, my story jumps in with the who.
Ah.
And going from war was not new to me to this idea that the courage of a woman named Esperance really was new to me. And that made all the difference in the area of wanting empathy, this virtue of empathy, to become very much like a spiritual discipline in my life. Esperance is still a dear friend. I met her on my first trip to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I traveled there with my dear friend and companion, Lynn Hiles, because we were disrupted. My husband had placed where a lot of other moms on Mother's Day get, you know, crayon cards from their kids or, you know, Hallmark, you know, or maybe even spa gift cards. I got a little article next to my coffee titled "Congo, the World's Worst Place to Be a Mother." And my husband knows me really well. Though a spa card, the idea of a spa card sounded awesome, he knew that my life needed a bit of disrupting. And after reading this article about these brave soul women who battle the battle of a war zone to take care of their families, but not only that, to take care of their communities, I really wanted to meet them. At the same time, my dear friend Lynn was driving home from a meeting, and she heard on an NPR newscast that this phrase, rape was cheaper than bullets in the DRC.
Yeah, I've read that. And you, I mean, you're just gutted, appalled. You're, you know, fill in the blank when you hear that statement. Whew.
You do. So, she is very keen to remind me that one phrase and one phrase only can guide you into the places that God has for you, and that is, what is mine to do? So we asked that, and ours to do, we thought, you know what? This is crazy, but let's go. Our dear friends at World Relief made a way for us to do that, and we took a small team. We had one goal, Anita. One goal was to spend time with about 15 women who had experienced gender-based violence and done some good, solid therapy work on their story, to bear witness to what they had experienced. And then, if at all possible, we said, to light our hair on fire so that, you know, news articles like that on NPR or like the article that I read in my on my Mother's Day would not be quite as shocking. It would at least be on people's radar for no other reason other than we are aware, we know, and something needs to be done about it. As we listened to these 15 women in what was at the time, believe it or not, an active conflict zone in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, we listened to Espérance. Now, Espérance means hope in French. She was the first woman to give us her story. She fled her village. She lost track of some of her children. She had to find some kind of stable place for her and her husband to land so they could regroup and find their kids and feed those that they had and survive. In order to do that, they had to go into the Virunga National Forest to gather firewood, to turn that firewood into coal, which when I've watched the process, it takes days, and it itself is an alchemy that is amazing, the amount of effort for a few pennies so that they can supplement UN foodstuffs for their whole family. Wow. While they were in the forest, they heard two rebel guards approach them. Mm-hmm. They gave very little warning. They shot Esperance's husband dead in front of her. And then they stripped her. They brutally raped her and left her for dead in the forest by herself with her dead husband. Now, Esperance would say that she would have died had it not been these amazing women whose job it was, commissioned by the local church, trained by the local church's lay trauma counselors, to scour the forest for women just like Esperance, to find them, and then, as they did for her, to take her to the local clinic, to get her rape treatment. And then for that, which takes a month, around 30 days, then they stayed with her for another 9 months as she chose to bring her son David to birth. Mm. And then another 12 months as she trained to become a lay trauma counselor herself, going out into the forest and using her, not only her experience, but her own, to keep bringing health to her own body. See, it wasn't Esperanza's suffering that blew me out of the water. It was her response to her suffering that stopped me on a dime and really changed the whole narrative of the way I wanted my own life to look.
Because after you tell that story, it's basically mic drop and let's go home, except there's so much more that we need to talk about. But I mean, you know, that's, you know, you hear a story like that. Yes. And it does something to you, number one. And I think it also has me asking then, and anyone, I think, you know, what how do I respond how to that story? Yeah. And how do I respond when these things enter my purview? So I think it's both of those things.
That was my question too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. What do I do?
Yeah. And also, I don't know that we've gotten yet, and it might be a good time just in the crack here of the conversation to get a good definition of empathy, or how you are talking about empathy, because I think we use some things that we think are synonyms, but they're not. They are their own words with their own meanings. And I think it'd be helpful for us to have you give a definition of empathy for us here.
Sure, absolutely. It actually fits perfectly with that next part of the story, in that after Esperance so generously gave us her story and showed us this inkling of what responding to other people's suffering in the world could look like and to your own suffering could look like, as you remember, we were hoping to light her hair on fire. We were hoping to write an article. So we wrote a piece for the Huffington Post, and then I wrote another piece for the Daily Beast, which was Newsweek at the time. And we needed Esperanza's permission to do that. 1 Million Thumbprints, our organization, is very careful about ethical storytelling. So we spent quite a bit of time. We asked the only person that she really trusted to help her navigate this, her pastor, to help her understand what it meant to tell her story out loud in print. And it took a while for that to happen. As far as I understand it, she got a little frustrated in that Esperance is pre-literate. And as she looked at this paper and it was being interpreted for her, she knew what she wanted from us. The only ask she made of me in that whole time together, those whole 3 days together, she didn't ask for food. She didn't ask for pity. The only thing she asked was this. She flipped the piece of paper over and had the pastor write in bold words, "Tell the world my story." And then because she's pre-literate, she stamped her thumbprint underneath it. Her thumbprint represents everything that she is. Mm. The only way that she could acquire goods and services in Congo was by leaving her thumbprint. Mm. That's what she put. That's what showed up in my inbox. That question of what is mine to do, Esperance was so kind in not beating about the bush. She helped me go from a nice option, or gosh, I wonder if this is a good thing, to a mandate. That came in the middle of this idea of what the heck have I gotten myself into? Because up to that point, you know, this is an extreme type of suffering, but we experience it every day, don't we? Mm-hmm. We experience our dear friends who's suffering in depression mm-hmm. is actually physically painful for them.
Yes.
Who just like you and I, are navigating the illness and potential death of a parent mm-hmm. who are themselves confronting the idea that they have cancer. I mean, the amount of suffering and tragedy around us overlaid with what is really truly a very culturally chaotic moment in time causes us to respond to other people's pain in a lot of interesting ways. And even though I had been a Christian for 30 years, and even though I had worked as a community developer with my husband in and out of conflict zones, confronting warlords, confronting disease, confronting starvation, certainly not just gender-based violence for the first time. Mm. All of this kind of conspired against me. And there were these three really high-functioning, super dysfunctional ways I was responding to suffering. Yeah. And none of them were empathy. Mm. None of them were this kind of spiritual direction empathy was beginning to take for me. So maybe by way of not defining empathy, I can define empathy for us.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think that's great. And for us to see even your how you were responding that was not empathy, I know will help us because we've either been there or we are there. So excellent.
Well, and I still go there quite frequently, to be honest. There was a new study, just briefly, there was a new study out yesterday from Penn State University. And the title, it's in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. Mm-hmm. And the title of the article that came across my desk was this: empathy is too much work for many of us. Mm-hmm. That was the conclusion of the study.
Wow.
And it made sense to me given the places that I so naturally went in my mind and in my heart when I was confronted with some pretty serious suffering in the world. I would take the tact of sympathy. Right. Was probably the easiest reach for us, those of us who are good Christian. Mm-hmm. And sympathy says something like, you know, I really care, but I really don't need to know what's going on. Mm.
Yeah.
It kind of becomes a quick fix. It's funny because my kids pointed out to me, they're 19 and 17. They pointed out to me that that's Homer Simpson's catchphrase. Just because I understand doesn't mean that I actually care.
That's funny. Okay. Yeah. Well,
it's like, okay. Uh-huh. Sympathy tends to alleviate guilt.
Yeah.
Sympathy really is a culturally acceptable response to the tension we're feeling, not to the tension the other person is feeling.
And I think we're quick to say, I'll pray, but don't give me too many details.
Yes.
We don't say, don't give me too many details. We just hear the headline and go, I'll pray to cut off what more we might hear, though we would never say that. We would never, describe it that way. Yeah.
No.
So I hear you.
That's that super high functioning part.
Yeah.
For me, my sympathy looked really good. Mm-hmm. And if sympathy wasn't quite making it for me, if that sympathetic therapy, I'll feel good in the process and at least this person will know that I care. Mm-hmm. In the midst of their suffering.
Yes.
If that wasn't working for me, I'd quickly reach for apathy. Now, I think a lot of us tend to think that apathy is this don't know, don't care, but it's much more insidious than that. And I actually think it's quite epidemic in our churches, as well as in our political structures now, anywhere where we find
I agree.
We find people, right, that really want, this is what apathy says. I know, but I don't really care.
Yeah.
So sympathy is saying I care, but I don't really need to know. Apathy is saying I know, I don't really care. And this is why. We want to Google it. We don't mind reading the study. We don't, you know, we can have our information about the cancer or about the moment or about the context. We're really good at diagnosing things. But then keeping the actual person that's suffering at complete arm's length.
Mm. I think one of the things that's at play also is if we know too much, it might require something of us, right?
It absolutely does. That moment of recognizing a responsibility to a person's suffering or even to their joy is that moment where you kind of go, oh, this is something different than the what I've been floating around in.
Yeah.
If apathy wasn't working for me, I find that a lot of folk, including myself, tend to want to reach for this third way called antipathy. Mm. And nowadays, I find that antipathy looks a lot like, remember when I said that angry protest?
Yeah.
Some of us just aren't satisfied with, look, I'm going to get out there. I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to build solidarity with this group of people. And it really just ends up looking like a angry march and not much gets done after that. It says, look, I don't know and I don't care. I'm not getting that invested. This is as far as I'll go. And even though it's all too real today, I think antipathy ends up looking a lot like self-righteousness getting loud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that sounds really harsh, but here's what makes the difference for empathy. If sympathy is, I really care, don't really care to know. If apathy is, I know, but I don't really care. And if antipathy is, don't know, don't care. Then empathy is that place that really is, it takes work to get there. It says, I know and understand. I care about what I understand. And I'm going to let both of those things inform my actions towards you as my brother, my sister, my fellow human on this planet.
Yes, that makes sense. I think it also begs a question as it relates to your story. I'm just thinking of someone listening and thinking, I hear this, but I do need Belinda to maybe go the next step because I realize, because sometimes we can feel like, but can I really make a difference if I'm not going to war-torn places? You know, how do I make a difference in the world in which I live and breathe? Whether I'm living in a retirement community, whether I'm a mom with young kids, whether I'm a guy that's working in a museum somewhere, how do I embody this and move forward in a way that can make a difference in the world and in the people in which are standing in front of me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was my question too, because coming home from meeting Esperance and then receiving this mandate was strangely simple. What was mine to do in the face of such complex, dire suffering? She made one simple ask of me, and that was, hear my story, listen to me. See my situation, understand the context in which my story happens, and then tell other people about it. Now, when you break it down to that, that was an ask that if I was to say no to, it would be a little heartless because it really was something that I could do.
Yeah,
I think...
I'm glad you thumbnail sketched the story again and didn't say tell the world, because really she's saying, and just tell someone, just tell someone.
Yeah.
And yes, I appreciated that. All of a sudden that made it real. Like, oh, I can do that. I can't ignore this. Yeah.
Nope. And I hear this all the time. Folks say, oh, oh, you wrote a book about empathy. I get it. I'm just not a very empathetic person.
Which I'm not sure I would admit. I don't think I would say that, actually, personally. But anyway.
And it was funny because InterVarsity Press, my editor, Cindy Bunch, has been a joy to work with. And she said at the beginning, way back when we started our early writing partnership, she asked me a really hard question, which seems natural. But she said, Belinda, is this book for people who have empathy or is it for people who need it?
Yeah, good. I thought, great question.
It was an absolutely great question, but that led me to this idea of like, well, you know what? I think it's for everyone because empathy is for everyone. Yeah. I don't think we get the pass that science may currently be giving us in saying empathy is not all it's cracked up to be. And maybe not everybody has it. And as I did my research with through a lot of the wonderful work of the University of Michigan, Cal Berkeley, and the University of Pennsylvania, as I looked at what was coming out of their scientific studies, their statement was more like, no, empathy is for everyone when we don't feel like it's something that happens to us. When we engage it much more like a virtue, like a passion, then our hormones, which look a lot like a combination of adrenaline and cortisol, mixing together, and our mirror neurons, which lie the neurons that cause us to yawn when somebody else's yawns,
yes.
or causes us to feel when somebody else stubs their toe. All of those things in our own makeup conspire to help us get to this place of empathy. And folk that don't even have a spiritual side to them, mm-hmm. say things like, well, actually, had empathy not existed at the core of us as a human species, we wouldn't have survived.
Isn't that interesting? That's interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
We needed to be able to not just have a sympathetic response or an apathetic response. Diagnosis only gets you a certain distance, and you know, being nice only gets you a certain distance. It's not going to help you and your people get the next meal together.
So can
it's not going to help you survive.
Let me interject this. I'd like your response to this, Belinda. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like someone that I meet on the street, you know, a stranger has more empathy than someone in my faith community. Now, not always, but I'm just saying sometimes the response is more, oh, just pray harder, trust more. Not when, you know what, I already know those things. Just give me some empathy. You know, I think sometimes the understanding of that in the broader world might actually be better. Now, I'm painting a very broad brushstroke, and that actually does not happen in my current faith community, but I've seen that happen in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I think my son summed it up really well when I was like knee deep in this book, and we took the boys to the Baltimore Aquarium, which was really fun. It was kind of like a release for us. And he was standing in front of one of those big, enormous tanks. And as a little guy, he was looking up and a barracuda kind of swam past him. I don't know if you've ever seen a barracuda up close, but they're ugly,
yes,
and enormous. But when you're looking at it through an aquarium tank, yes, those big leaded glass, it looked three times the size of itself. And Caleb turned around to us and said to Stephen and I, oh my gosh, and it's an obstacle illusion.
Oh, that's great. Obstacle illusion. Great.
And obstacle illusion. And I remember thinking to myself, that's exactly right, baby. That's the way I look. That's maybe the way I see other people's pain. As an obstacle illusion. We confront, you know, we confront some super simple stuff like, oh my gosh, I am currently overwhelmed with everything I have to navigate to, you know, I just got a cancer diagnosis. But if we aren't feeling other people's pain, or if we're feeling too much of other people's pain, those are both obstacle illusions to us. As we try to engage empathy, this knowing, caring, and informing our own actions towards people. So I talk about this a little bit in the book and have some pretty practical
ways. You read my mind. You just read my mind. I was just sitting here going, let's get practical, because you know, because I think you really do have to do what you just did and really lay the foundation. I think that's important, because I think we are struggling today with empathy. Yeah. So I think that foundation is critical. But yeah, let's get practical here, because I know someone is going, okay, how can I engage and be do a better job with empathy? So yeah, go for it.
Awesome. For those of us that engage practices in our life, whether or not we're coming from a faith community, empathy practiced as a spiritual discipline is probably the easiest frame that I look at. And spiritual disciplines, whether they are Christian or Buddhist or Hindu, they tend to take the same definition. I personally like Dallas Willard's definition of spiritual discipline, where he said, we pursue in our own power. So we pursue these disciplines in our own power so that we can then do something beyond our power. So you can kind of see, if we're looking at other people's pain as this barracuda-sized problem, whether or not we're in Michael's, you know, picking up bric-a-brac, you know, and the woman in front of us decides to explain to us how her suffering in her life, or whether we're in a church pew knowing that our pastor just announced he has cancer. If we are practicing empathy as a spiritual discipline, in a couple of different key areas, I think we're more ready to know, care, and then inform have our actions informed towards that person on the spot. And there are three key behaviors that I've dialed down on in the book that make empathy a practice rather than just a really good idea.
Nice.
The first one is perspective taking. Which looks a lot like, okay, I'm going to shapeshift with this person right now. For those of us that love science fiction, I am a Doctor Who fan to my core, which is probably freaking out some of your folk right now. Yes, I love the way things are bigger on the inside than they are on the outside. This idea of, I can stand even in a Starbucks line and figure out why the guy in front of me is so grumpy right now. If I can close my eyes and kind of switch places with him, it's a practice. It actually takes concentration to try to actually physically see what he's seeing with his eyes. Mm-hmm. Is he seeing a barista, or is he seeing somebody who's just providing a service? What do you think maybe could change his day right now? That seems a little elementary, but we don't do it as often as we should. So perspective taking is moving from my here to there. It's actually a movement in our body, in our mind, in our listening, to understanding that person's perspective. Mm. The second one is something that I get the biggest pushback on, and that's empathetic listening.
Huh.
But I love what theologian Paul Tillich said about it. He said, listening is the first duty of love.
And
then Bonhoeffer followed it up. I do too. Bonhoeffer followed it up with this. This is where the conviction came. Half-eared listening despises the brother and is only waiting for the chance to speak.
Preach, preach. Yeah. Yes. But we have to learn that. Well, learn and relearn and continue struggling to practice that. Thank you. That's a good one.
Amen.
Yeah. Love that.
Amen.
Quote.
So that one of the best things that I've learned for listening is this concept of pre-listening, which is a practice of just paying attention to what am I doing before I start listening? Am I actually able to physically hear? Am I able to hold myself still to hear what the person is saying? Even if you get ambushed, and it's okay to stop that person and say, hey, could you just hold that for a second? Could we move over here where it's a little bit more quiet? Could you just wait? I just need to kind of clear my head so that I can give you the listening that you need right now.
Yes.
There's a great little test that IVP put together. It's one of those fantastic little digital tests that can kind of help you assess your listening skills. So if you go to Brave Souls at IVP, you can take that test and it'll give you a little bit of feedback on maybe where you're struggling, maybe where you're really good.
And I'll link that in the show notes too for people, because I think that'd be really kind of a cool thing for people to do.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Be awesome. So we've got this perspective taking and listening. And then the final practical thing that we should be spending our days doing is I call it peacemaking in the book, but really it's learning to become a non-anxious presence in this world. To allow ourselves to not be thrown by conflict, to not freak out when we're not right or the winner of something, but actually to lean into what I call these beautiful collisions that we have throughout our day, and practice inside of conflict, perspective taking and listening. Hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot to take in Brave Souls. And I think it's very important work that you've done and that you have called us to as well. I'm wondering what you're hoping people, what is your best hope that people will take away from Brave Souls? You know, if they just grab one thing or a couple things, what's your hope?
Yeah. I think if folk could simply understand that empathy isn't what we think it is, and that it's not for saints. For gurus. It's not for the politically correct or the politically incorrect. You pick your camp, right?
Right.
It is for everyone. It's skill-based, and it's able to be learned by all. If we can walk away from our dysfunctional, high-functioning, dysfunctional responses to other people's lives. Swinging wildly at sympathy or apathy or antipathy and calling it a functional response and start embracing the hard work of empathy, I really think this low-grade simmer that we're all on, this anxiety that seems to be rising, in all of us would begin to look much more like concrete movement forward instead of stewing in cultural chaos that we're in right now. Is that too much to ask?
Yeah, no. I was going to say, you just said a mouthful, but it's a way forward, and it's a much needed way forward where we are living today, in the church, outside the church, wherever we are. So I'm grateful. It does give us something to move forward with and to walk away with. Thank you so much. I mean, I'm glad you met Esperance. And that seems even like a statement you don't want to make because you think about what happened to her. But I'm glad that you encountered God through her story and move forward in a way that we can hear and understand. So thank you for that. And thank you for joining me on Faith Conversations. Really appreciate it.
What a joy to be with you today, and grateful for your listeners, grateful for them being willing to tackle not just the super, you know, the super linear stuff, but being willing to jump into the middle of a story, which is so often more circular than we like them to be.
That's a great statement.
What a gift.
That's a great statement.
Good people.
Yeah. Well, and I always say, you know, you don't necessarily know this, but at the end, and I'll say it again today, I always tell people, keep the conversation